So, after the children go out, I'm going to be answering questions from everybody who's left in the room. But that doesn't leave much time to answer questions from the children. So, I figured the children might have some questions too. So, Miss Beth, would you help me out here? I don't know how much time we're going to have to answer questions, but how many questions I'm going to get to. But if any of the children who are going outside today or downstairs or upstairs, some children are going upstairs and some are going outside. But if you're going out before I answer the questions from the folks who are staying and you have some burning questions about church, why do we come to church? How did we get to be Unitarian Universalists? Questions about theology. Oh, that's a big word. What is theology? I don't know. I don't know what your questions are. You can raise your hand and Miss Beth will answer your question.
Why is it called Unitarian Universalists?
That's a really good question. Why is it called Unitarian Universalist? So there were two churches, the Unitarian Church. Now the Unitarians started, some Unitarians started in the 1500s. In Central Europe, and there was a little tiny thread. You know what a little tiny thread is? Like, they didn't actually move, but there was a little bit of a connection, but some of those Unitarians were also in England, and then more Unitarians came up in the United States, but it wasn't exactly the same church. The Unitarians didn't believe so much in the Trinity. They didn't believe so much in the divinity of Jesus. They didn't believe that Jesus was the same as God. And they had an idea that God had a lot more to do with grace than punishment. So there was that idea, the Unitarian Church. And they'd been around for a long time. And then there were the Universalists. And they came up in around the late 1700s. And they believed that God was just too good to condemn people to hell for all eternity. So they believed in universal salvation. So there was the Unitarian Church and there was the Universalist Church. And they existed side by side for a long time until 1961. Well, they were doing some things together. In the 1930s, they made one hymnal together. And starting in like the 1950s, the youth groups from both churches were doing things together, the kids. And then in 1961, they finally got together and said, hey, we should just be together all the time. And they merged and they talked a long time about what the name should be and whether there should be a hyphen or not. Well, because it changes the meaning, right? Oh, semantics, that's another big word. And they decided no hyphen, so that means that the type of universalists we are Unitarian Universalists. So we kept both names. It's really long. But we're Unitarian Universalists. How did they decide which? Well, that's a question for the grown-ups. There's a question back there, Miss Beth.
Before I got to you, when was Brew founded and made?
Brew was founded in 1981, is that right? 1981, and it was founded by people who came largely from the Fairfax Church and some other people in Prince William County. And for a long time, Brew met in other places. Brew didn't have our own building. And then in, 1999, Brewers took a really big step because they already had some property someplace else, but this building became available, and the people who made up Brew at that time bought this building, and this became our home. No, that right there was a question right there. Yeah, right in front of you.
Oh, she was pointing out that the young man that was...
Oh, that was his question. Okay. I think I have time for maybe one more question. Does you have a question? Okay, last question.
Why was Brew founded? Why did you come to Brew?
Why did I personally come to Brew? That's a really good question. So I'm an interim minister right now, so I came to Brew because whenever a settled minister leaves, it's good for a congregation to take some time to examine itself, to take a look at who we are or who you are. And I considered carefully the churches that were looking for an interim minister. And I don't live too far away. I kind of wanted to stay in my house. So that was part of the decision. But I considered carefully, and I had an interview with the search team, and Ms. Beth was on the search team. And I really liked the things that they were saying to me. And it sounded to me like the folks here really wanted to do the work that is required. Because it's a lot of work. Who thinks it's been a lot of work? Anybody? It has been, right? But it sounded like folks really wanted to do the work. And so I said, I want to come and love these folks and love all of you and help you do the work. I can't stay. I can't stay. That's kind of the job. I'm good, but I'm so excited that I think you're going to get such a great minister who's going to be able to stay with you for a long time. And what a great question. So my job is to help you get ready for your new minister. So thank you for those wonderful questions. And now is the time that we're going to get ready to sing the children out. So I'm going to ask the ushers to come forward and get baskets and collect the questions from the rest of you. And I'm going to ask the children to come up for the children and everybody taking them out to come forward for a blessing while we start to collect those questions. So if you're leaving to go upstairs or downstairs, come forward. Okay, is this everybody? May you learn and grow and teach each other and become repairers of the world. Amen. So Beth is going to ask questions, and I'm going to do my best to answer them. And we'll see how many we can get through. And those we can't get through, I will do my best to answer in Roundup. Is that okay? And we'll
see.
You've
got a lot of Roundup questions.
I got a lot of Roundup questions. Okay, we'll see what we can do here.
There are several that are similar, so I'm going to kind of do an amalgam here.
Okay.
How did two Christian-based religions morph into a religion which incorporates philosophies and theologies of other religions?
Great question. So in 1933, a bunch of people got together, not necessarily Unitarians and Universalists, although there were a lot of Unitarians, and signed on to what's called the Humanist Manifesto. Anybody know about the Humanist Manifesto? Okay. There were several Reformed Jewish rabbis who signed on to this and a bunch of other people. And strangely, there's a copy of this hanging in my study because my internship congregation gave it to me as a going away present, knowing what a strong atheist humanist I am. Yeah. There's a question about that, too. So there's a copy of the Humanist Manifesto, an updated version of it in my study. So the Humanist Manifesto, but a lot of Unitarian ministers had signed on to this. Okay. Now, getting into the mid part of the 20th century, although these were both two Christian churches, more and more Unitarians were becoming... Now, humanism, understand, is not Christian. I mean, the original humanists were Catholic, actually, right? Humanism just places the importance of human interaction and humanity above scholasticism and arguing about how many angels can dance on the head of a pin, right? So it's about human interaction. But more and more among Unitarians, there was this strong humanism and less talk of God. So during the merger in 1961, there was intentional talk about the language we were using and wanting to be welcoming of all these people, because the Universalists were still very Christian, right? And if you go to a lot of the churches in New England, there are still a lot of very Christian, Unitarian, and Universalist churches in New England. But they wanted to put language into the covenant and into the forming documents that would be intentionally welcoming of these folks who were, by and large, atheist and atheist-leaning, right? So a lot of the very specific Christian language was removed, and that opened a lot of floodgates. And ever since the merger, we've always been covenantal. I mean, even when we were two Christian churches, we were, even going back to the Cambridge Platform of 1648, we were covenantal, not creedal. We never said, you have to believe this in order to be a member of the church. So ever since the merger, it's just been more and more, well, we're not telling you what to believe, and we have a covenant, and here's what the covenant states. And then in the 80s, we wrote the covenant, and we've tweaked it since then, but with the seven principles and now the six sources of faith, and we're examining if we're going to add an eighth principle. And so more and more people started finding a home here who had beliefs that were outside what was the traditional Christian belief. Okay.
Since you raised your personal philosophy, there are several people that have asked, what was your path from Judaism to UUism and to ministry?
What was my path from Judaism to UUism to ministry? Okay. Simple question that I can answer in 30 seconds. or more. Okay. So I was always the religious one in my family, you'll be shocked to know. I was the one who insisted that my parents send me to Hebrew school, and then that we go to Shabbat services and do Shabbat at home. But we were going to a conservative synagogue, and when I was bat mitzvah in 1975, and yes, you can go ahead and do the math, I'm not hiding my age, I was not allowed to read from Torah because I was a girl. I was allowed to read a Haftorah portion. And frankly, the rabbi spent no time with me. He gave me a tape to memorize, and that's how I learned my Haftorah portion. I didn't even know what I was singing. Because he didn't spend any time with me to learn it. And I was still going to Hebrew school after that, and in Hebrew high school, I just started to question whether I really thought God thought I was a second-class citizen or not. You know, why am I not being allowed to read from Torah? Why am I not being allowed to have an aliyah to go up to the bima and to recite the prayers and to hold the Torah and do all that? I didn't think that that's what God wanted. I thought that's what the men in the synagogue wanted. And I felt pushed out. Well, being in high school is a formative time. And then I went to college and I read Karl Marx, right? Marx is right, man, religion is the opiate of the masses. Well, it can be. It can be used. Anything can be used for good or ill, most things. But I was never, I never was an atheist. I had never turned my back. I just was kind of done with the way things were there. Well, I'd moved to Northern Virginia in the late 80s, and I was singing in a Methodist church choir in exchange for voice lessons. What choir needs sopranos? I don't know, but this guy did. And I don't know. And it was across from the UU church in Arlington. And I was having a conversation with a friend one day and about theology and philosophy. He says, you sound just like a Unitarian Universalist. You should check them out. And they were across the street from the church that I was singing in, so I knew where it was. So one Sunday I walked in. It was right around the time when The Last Temptation of Christ came out. And I remember the first or second sermon I heard was on The Last Temptation of Christ. I said, oh, this is fantastic. The UU Church helped me rediscover everything that I loved about Judaism. It also introduced me to the New Testament. And I wasn't willing at that time to say I was a Christian, and now I do, and I'm Jewish also, and I'm both and that works for me, and it's weird, but okay. Now, around that same time is when I heard the call to nursing. Nursing? What? I heard the call to nursing. I was swimming in the Yates Fieldhouse at Georgetown University, and I in the middle of the pool, it came to, oh, my goodness, I'm supposed to be a nurse. Okay. So I went to nursing school and I became a nurse practitioner, but early in the time that I was going to church, I mean, early in the 90s, shortly after becoming a nurse, I'd heard the call to ministry. Of course, this was to community ministry. I was never going to be a parish minister, you understand. And I put that call on hold for a long time. Now, in my theology, you know, I'm a theist. I'm a very strong theist. So I'm going to frame this in my own theology. God is persistent. And that call just kept getting louder and louder and louder until 2008. It started coming through a bullhorn. And I was just, well, all right, already, I will go to seminary, fine. And I entered seminary, and it took me 6 years. And all through seminary, I kept saying, well, but I am called to chaplaincy. I am not called to parish ministry. God is so funny. And she didn't want to scare me too much, so she didn't tell me about the parish ministry part until way at the end. And I'm and surprise! And I love parish ministry so much, and I love you all so much. And that's my path. And I feel like it's part of the same calling from nursing. It's, you know, I had to do the nursing first because, man, my hubris was so much it would have just filled this whole space. I would have been a really crappy minister in my 20s, can I tell you?
I have been criticized by people of other religious beliefs for being a UU, that it's not religious enough, that it's more of a social club, that it's not spiritual enough. What's the answer? What do I say?
I'm sorry that that's happened to you. So I can't remember who said this first, because this is not my, so I'm using somebody else's words, but And I don't remember whom to attribute this to. Okay, but we often judge our own faith by the best practitioners, by our highest ideals, and other faiths by their worst practitioners. Right. So, radical Islam. I mean, there are 6 million or a couple of billion practitioners of Islam around the world. I mean, if they were really all radicals, you know. Or, the Crusades. Well, not every Christian, right? The Crusades. I mean, yes, they were bad, and we should own that stuff, but, you know. So, yes, at our worst, can UUs be a social club? Yeah, I've seen that happen, sure. But, and that might have been somebody's experience of a UU church, but I think what I would say to somebody is, well, have you ever been to a UU church? What was your experience? And if that was your experience, If the person says yes and that was their experience, I'd say, well, I'm sorry. If you'd like to come and see what we do at our congregation, we're not a social club. We do real church. I'll tell you also that just like there are developmental stages, you know, as we grow, there are developmental spiritual stages. We experience spiritual growth. And people are on different paths, and some people are never going to get beyond the very lowest level. My faith is right, your faith is wrong. I mean, we can't waste time arguing with somebody like that, because what are you going to say to somebody who, I would say, don't waste your breath with that person. It's really a big, powerful thing when we realize that there are so many paths. And my faith isn't better than your faith. My faith is the faith for me. And your faith is the faith for you. But if somebody's experience of Unitarian Universalism has been, well, I went to a church once and it was just a social club. Well, I mean, did you ever have a teacher who was a crappy teacher and didn't teach? Does that mean that all teachers are crappy teachers and don't teach? Right? Have you ever been on a flight where people were surly and the flight attendants were mean? Does that mean all flight attendants are mean, right? That would be my answer.
How can new members help strengthen and support BRU and the congregation?
Excellent question. How can new members help strengthen and support the congregation? So one of my favorite theologians, Howard Thurman, said, don't ask what the world needs, Ask what makes you come alive, because what the world needs is more people who have come alive. So I would say that applies to church as well. What Brew needs is people who are doing things that they are enthusiastic about. So if you are the person who is totally jazzed about administration and finance and spreadsheets, join finance. If you love nothing more than digging weeds and planting gardens, then join Mac. See Amy. If you love nothing more than working with children and doing arts and crafts, oh my goodness, see Kristen. Kristen Worthington, our Director of Religious Education. If you are a governance geek, if you love how that all works, oh my goodness, run for the board. Talk to the nominating committee and be part of church governance. So what we need is people who are jazzed about what they're doing. Don't be on a committee because you think, well, it's a drudgery, but somebody has to do that. Do what makes you come alive, and then we'll have a church full of volunteers who love what they're doing.
A two-parter. Will God forgive you even if and when you cannot forgive yourself? And that seems to my mind to kind of go hand in hand with, we as UUs don't focus on sin per se. We're all saved, after all. But how or what do you see as useful ways for us to face the tendency we all have to break relationships? What can our church teach us about meaningfully moving towards wholeness?
Fabulous questions. Well, on the sin question, stay tuned because I was planning to preach on that in August. Ooh. These are excellent questions. As a universalist, yes, I believe God will absolutely forgive all of us, and God is patient beyond any of us. Now, in my personal theology, and you understand I'm talking about my personal theology because we don't teach this is the only way. And here's a secret. Many Christian churches do not teach this is the only way. There are so many atonement and salvation theologies even within a church that you still have to work on your own. Did you know that? Ooh. But I believe that we do have to eventually forgive ourselves, and God will wait, and God is there waiting with open arms, and God has forgiven us already. God is waiting for us to enter into God's presence. Now, there are ultra-universalists. The ultra-universalists are the death and glory. I don't come here in t-shirts often. Have any of you ever seen the death and glory t-shirt? My daughter is raising her hand because she owns one. I own one. She's seen me in it, yeah. She only has the love the hell out of this world shirt, yeah. Have any of you, so the death and glory shirt is the universalist circle with the universalist cross in it and a skull. I love this shirt. And it says death and glory, because that's ultra-universalism. You die and you're immediately restored to God. Death and glory. And the restorationist universalists are those of us who believe that there has to be some atonement work. There has to be some work. But I personally still believe that that work is within us. God is waiting there with open arms for all of us to enter in. Now, as to the sin question, and read that part again. How can we restore? Is that about restoring?
Will God forgive you even when you cannot forgive yourself? And we, as you use, don't focus on sin per se because of the universal salvation. But how or what do you see as useful ways for us to face the tendency we all have to break relationships and teaching us towards moving meaningfully towards wholeness?
Absolutely. So in Judaism, a definition of sin is, well, the literal meaning of sin is the dictionary definition of the word is missing the mark, right? And in Judaism, we talk about that. It's missing the mark. So if you shot an arrow and you didn't hit a bullseye, you missed the mark, right? So we aim for something and we miss. That's what we talk about with sin. So we have this aspirational goal, and when we miss it, when we fall short, that's when we sin, when we fall away from God, however you understand God to be. That's when we sin. So how can we repair this? How can we be whole with one another? Well, we can take stock of ourselves. We can learn from our mistakes. Anybody here never made a mistake? Okay. Even Jesus was schooled. Do you know the story of the Syrophoenician woman? Any of you know the story? She comes to him, and he's all, "Oh, get away. I'm here for the Israelites. You know, it's not right to feed the dogs." When he actually calls her a dog. "It's not right to feed the dogs when the children haven't been fed." And she's all, "Oh, hell no." Even the dogs get the scraps from the table. And Jesus is all, "Oh, snap. Well, your daughter's healed. Dang," right? So even Jesus has been schooled, right? So if even Jesus can mess up from time to time, that's all I'm saying. So we learn from our mistakes. That's the first thing. We can learn from the things that we've done. And I don't know about you, but I have messed up really big time sometimes. Like I've hurt people. I'm not going to ask you to raise your hands, but anybody here ever hurt somebody else? I'm not asking you to raise your hands, right? You don't have to admit it to anybody. So when we know that we've done this, we can learn from that. We can say, okay, what did I do, and how can I take steps not to do that going forward? So that's one. We can make amends when possible. Sometimes attempting to make amends can do more harm than good, right? So we always have to consider the person who's been hurt, but we can make amends when possible. And however we understand the holy, you know, in Judaism on the Day of Atonement, we prepare by making amends when possible, and then we all confess our sins together, right? We stand in the synagogue, literally stand, all day on Yom Kippur, and we confess all the sins together. All the sins, just in case we forgot one that we did. We confess all the sins. Then when it's something that we know we did, it's, "Oh yeah, I remember that one," right? So we confess all our sins to God, and then we start with a blank slate and we move forward. And I think that, I personally, maybe because I grew up with that, I think that's a pretty good way to do things, to recognize what we've done, to make amends when possible, to make change within ourselves, and to at least atone in our hearts, to apologize, to know that the intent is there, and to move forward.
How can a traditionally, parenthetically, white suburban church become more racially integrated into the lives of other racial and cultural churches?
I love that you're throwing me all the softballs. That is a good question. Okay, so there are many steps to becoming truly multicultural. And the first step is to start thinking about diversity. Do you know the difference between diversity and multiculturalism? No. Okay, so diversity is what I like to call hues in the pews, right? Diversity is you're welcome here as long as you start becoming like us. So, you know, in the United States, I mean, for a long time, it would, the Daughters of the American Revolution, the DAR, would be at Ellis Island teaching people to become American. Shed your traditional clothing and you learn how to speak American, and here are some good American names for your children, right? And they thought they were doing a real service. Come and be like us. That's diversity, which is a step and is important. But true multiculturalism is being willing to be changed by others, by being willing to be changed. So the first is to learn and to do things with other groups. But the next thing is to be willing to be changed. So we're along that path, right? We do some interfaith stuff. We're involved in voice, and we do things with. I keep wanting to say Dar al Hijra because that's the mosque near me in Falls Church, but it's Dar al Noor. Thank you, is here locally, and we do some things with them and the interfaith things. But if we really want to take a big step forward, then we need to start examining, well, am I willing to change, like, really how I do things? Can we have different food? Am I willing to have, like, other people's food at potlucks? Can we run meetings differently? This year at General Assembly, we took a big step in still having the bones of Robert's rules, but understanding that the rules serve us, we don't serve the rules, and stepping aside from how we've generally done business with Robert's rules, recognizing that even Robert's rules can serve to perpetuate white privilege and white male privilege very much, right? Examining our own privilege more and more. And some of this is uncomfortable, but, you know, being intentional about what we're doing. Looking at things critically. Well, you know, not doing tokenism, not making sure that we have a person of color in every picture or multiple people of color when our church is largely white, because that would be presenting a false picture. But how are we being welcoming to other people? Are we willing to have music that's not speaking to me directly but might be speaking to somebody else in the pews? We have a large Latinx community right here. Are we willing to do things in Spanish here? These are the questions that we need to ask ourselves.
It seems as if seems that UU religion gets no promotion, and very few even know about us as a world religion. That's kind of intro. It seems also that the Universalist beliefs and practices are not promoted as much as the Unitarian. How do we promote and practice the love of people without judgment? And establish an identity in the world?
Well, I will say, first of all, that we are a tiny, tiny denomination. Okay, so I think we just have to own that. We sometimes like to think that we're this great big. We're tiny. We have about 1,000 UU churches. One Methodist conference, so like the Central Pennsylvania Conference, has about 1,000 Methodist churches, right? So just to put that in perspective. Okay. We are tiny. I'm not particularly worried personally about numbers, but yes, we could be evangelizing more. So how do we get that message out? Well, the main way really is word of mouth, is bring a friend to church. So bring a friend to church. But then how do we keep people in church? And also practicing our religion. I heard a person in a church say once, you know, I was at work and this thing happened and I realized I was applying the 7 principles. I was living them at work. It wasn't just for church. And I thought, oh, honey, yeah, that is kind of the point. It's not just supposed to be an hour on Sunday. So being conscious of living your religion every day and not being shy about saying, yes, I am a religious person. You are religious people because you're already here practicing your religion. To be a religious person doesn't have to mean that you believe in the Father, the Son, and the Holy Spirit, okay? You can be a religious, but even if you're an atheist, you are a religious, you are not a secular humanist. You are a religious atheist because you're here, okay? If you're a humanist, you're not a secular humanist because you're in church. The secular humanists are out there, not in church. You are a religious humanist. So be out and loud about who you are. And don't be afraid to say, well, my church or my religion teaches me that. And I think that's how we get that word out there, practicing our faith every day. We are. How many of you know who the Swedenborgians are? Right, one, two of you. Okay, wow, that's like a lot. I mean, they're tiny. They're tiny. And that's okay, but they do what they do. It's okay to be small. We are small and mighty. Can you say that? We are small and mighty. We can do that. We can be small and mighty. Because when we come together and say something, I mean, every once in a while we get on the front page of a paper, right? If we do our stuff intentionally, we know what we stand for, and we remember that we are a religion and not a social club and not a social justice organization. I mean, we do social justice, but we are a religious organization doing social justice with a foundation of faith, right? Because we can just go join the JCs otherwise, right? Then that's how we continue to grow and get the word out there and reach others. I think we could do one more and go over 5 minutes. Right?
Okay. So for our final question, what, other than Monty Python, what is the meaning of life?
42. And who got the 42 joke? A bunch of you. Okay. The meaning of life, I mean, yeah, that's a great one to end on. The meaning of life, I think, is what we make out of it. The meaning of life is up to us to make. How many of you have a personal mission statement? A personal mission statement. A handful of you. I know what my mission is. Are you interested? My mission is to serve God. That is my mission. Everything I do revolves around that. That helps to give my life meaning, but I don't know. I don't have all the answers. And I tell people, when I die, I'll ask God. But I think it's up to us, particularly as human. And here's the other secret. As Unitarian Universalists, I have yet to meet a Unitarian Universalist who isn't a humanist. I mean, I am profoundly Jewish and Christian and a humanist, right? I think it's up to us to make meaning out of our own lives. With that, I promise you I will look at all the questions and do my best to answer them in roundup. Namaste.